Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Oh, hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Sam Bennett. She's the author of her new book, Start Right Where You Are. She is also an actor, and I knew her back in the late 80s, early 90s, at Second City, where she was a performer, improviser, and teacher. The reason I wanted to have her on, because this book talks about a lot of things that we've talked about in the last 5 years on this podcast. Things that block us, things that get in our way of our success, of our creativity, of our career. And we talk about in this interview, which was a phone interview, about the fear of success. We talk about how important it is to take care of yourself. We talk about self-care. We also talk about picking projects. Improvisers, I know I do, always have this habit of like saying yes to every project, hoping that one's going to come in and make them famous like they're playing the lottery. So in this book, in her book, and in this interview, Sam gives us, and I refer to her as Samantha because that's what I knew her as at Second City, gives us tools to overcome these things. And, you know, you've heard me talk about it in a very negative way, I think. And hopefully she's going to provide the solution. And I, of course, always provide the problem. I just want to say, as you listen to this, and you may be a little annoyed with me, because I think I was annoyed with myself. I think I was trying too hard in this interview. I was trying to like make sure, you know, you guys got it, you know, about improv and tying all the concepts. And really, I probably could have trusted my instincts a little more. So I just if I seem a little I don't even know what the word is. But if you get annoyed by me because I'm trying too hard, just know that I felt the same thing. Enough about me. You're going to love this episode. Samantha gives you really simple tools to deal with some of the stuff that we've been talking about for the last 5 years. So I know it's going to help you because I felt a little amped up, a little inspired after interviewing. Here it is, the Samantha Bennett episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
The reason I'm so excited to have you on the show, and this is kind of, for our listeners, it's kind of different. You know, usually I bring somebody on, and you have certainly, you have this great improv and acting background. And as I read your book, and this podcast, you know, is really dedicated to hopefully inspiring people and making people, you know, go as far as they possibly can. So when I read your book, I was like, okay, you have so many helpful tools to people that are improvising, they're in comedy, and they feel stuck. So we're going to focus on your book because I think that hopefully at the end of this podcast, people will have real tangible tools to get them unstuck. Now, let's start first. Why do you think people do get stuck in reaching their goals?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think there's as many different reasons as there are people, but they do tend to fall into categories. I think perfectionism is a big one. I think unrealistic expectations is a big one. I think school kind of messes us up a little bit because in school, you know, you're sort of supposed to know the answers in advance. In fact, you often know the questions in advance and the answers. So I think people get an idea of something they want to do and then think, well, I don't know how. You know, yeah, I'd love to write a book, but I don't know how. I'd love to have a career in comedy, but I don't know how. It's like, well, no one knows how. Of course you don't know how. You've never done it before. You've got to get into what I call like the sparkly breadcrumb stage. You know, you got to start moving your feet and then the way becomes clear. We make the path by walking it.
And in your book, Start Right Where You Are, you basically, the whole point you're trying to make is
All it does is it takes little changes in your life that can make a big difference. And in the beginning of your book, you talk about 8 tips to get unstuck. And one of them that I think is really, really important for improvisers is because the improv community, the comedy community is very, the culture is very much like, we like to complain, we like to gossip, we like to badmouth. And you say, turn those complaints into requests. Can you explain?
Yeah, that's actually something that came from my family. My mom always said that you were not allowed to complain about something unless you were either willing to take responsibility for making it better or had a suggestion about how to make it better.
That really whole complain thing for me. That
yeah.
Really just kills it.
Yeah, it just takes it right out. So, and what it's really about is taking responsibility. So, you know, if you find yourself standing there mad every morning because your partner has left the wet towel on the floor, you know, rather than nagging and complaining, which the main thing about nagging and complaining is to notice that it's a really crappy strategy. You know, it just doesn't work. So if you're trying to change things through nagging and complaining, notice that it doesn't work. You can't even nag yourself into doing things, much less anybody else.
But Samantha, it feels so good when I do it in my life.
Short term, it feels good. Long term, it feels crappy. And this is what spiritual maturity is all about, Jimmy, is giving up those short term satisfactions for a longer term, deeper contentment.
And people listening right now, I don't mean to take you off track. We'll go back to it. They hear spiritual maturity and they're like, well, that really doesn't apply. I'm an improviser. Why do I need that in improvising? Why do I need that in my comedy career?
See, improvising, I think, is the greatest tool for spiritual maturity of all time. I mean, the fundamental rules of acceptance, of listening, of presence, of exploration, of you know, following the follower, like, it's very theological, really, if you get into it.
So getting back to turning your complaints into requests, how would that work for somebody like me?
Yeah, so there's the wet towel on the floor. And rather than just, you know, swearing and stomping your feet or rolling your eyes or getting upset, you say, sweetheart, could you hang up the towel when you're done? And you're running the risk that your sweetheart may say yes or they may say no. And you may give them a little more context. You know, you may say, sweetheart, I noticed that when the wet towel is on the floor, that the wet towel doesn't want to be on the floor. The wet towel wants to be hung up so it can dry and not get all mangy and gross. Could you help me accomplish that goal? But again, they may say no. And your best bet may be for you to hang up the towel because clearly you are the one who cares about it.
What about me who is totally screwed up, who would hold on to the resentment of asking my wife to pick up the wet towel? So this would be months and months and months and months. How is that getting in the way of me getting what I want in life?
Yeah. So do you want to be right or do you want to be peaceful?
Are you asking?
Sure.
It depends on the day, but for the most part, I'd like to be successful.
Yeah. And I think success, going back to this idea of, you know, what does spiritual maturity have to do with a career in comedy? Like the ability to not take things so personally, to think long-term, to not be so reactive, to use your emotionality and your imagination for good, is a key to success. And the need to be right and the desire to be right is deep. You know, we love to be right. And there's nothing like complaining to make a person feel like they're right. But if you're willing to give that up, if you're willing to set that down for just a second and go, well, what do I really want? You know, what I really want is a dry towel in the morning. Then you can often get more of what you want and you can have a quieter time inside of your own brain.
I guess also what I'm hearing is, and I struggle with this, you're letting go of being a victim. And that's a huge thing, I think, in improv and comedy and acting and stuff, because in a lot of ways, we do feel like we're victims because there's so much rejection.
Yeah, and it's really easy to fall into that victim mentality. I've done it. Everyone I know has done it. It's really easy. But I'm telling you right now, the key to a happy life, when you start taking 100% responsibility for the results in your life and your reaction to it, You will. I mean, it's how I went from broke and crying on a couch in North Hollywood to six figures by the beach.
I love hearing this. I love hearing this. The other thing you mentioned happiness. And I think another thing I think of, I suffer from this as well. And a lot of improvisers, I think, suffer from it as well. If I get on a TV show, if I get Saturday Night Live, if I get on a house team at UCB, if I get hired by Second City, I'm going to be happy.
Yeah, locating your happiness in the future is a really destructive game. And it, in some ways, was really the turning point for me, as I realized that that's what I was doing. If I get this gig, if I lose this weight, if I can meet this person, if I can nail this pitch, if I, you know, I was locating my happiness in the future every single time. And sometimes those goals would happen and sometimes they wouldn't, but it wasn't changing how I was feeling on the inside. So I realized I needed to unhook my energy from these future events and bring my focus and attention back to the present moment, to this present moment right now. When I say start right where you are, I don't mean like later this afternoon after lunch. I mean now. What can you do right now to make your life a more, maybe not happy, happy can be kind of an overrated word, I think, but more joyful, more full? How can you be more present for your actual life? And so that means we're focusing on mindset, what's happening inside of your brain, and the things that your hands and feet can touch right now. That's your sphere of influence.
So if you were to coach me, we're doing an interview right now. What is the thing that I need to focus on right now doing this interview with you?
I would start with your well-being. So making sure that you are fed, rested, cuddled, meditated, walked, creatively fulfilled, you know, that you have taken time in the morning or throughout the course of your day so that you can really show up fully. You know, there's often, I think, a race, you know, there's some giant international game of busy poker going on, you know, like, oh, I'm so stressed out, I'm so overwhelmed. And particularly in improv, you know, we work really late nights and we're on, then we've got a full-time job and we're often exhausted. But you can be busy without the story of being busy. You can be busy without the story of being stressed out. You know, be busy like a trapeze artist is busy. Be busy like an improviser is busy. You know, you're processing a lot of information on stage, but you're moving very deliberately.
So to an improviser who's doing, you know, today improvisers are doing, you know, four classes and they're doing open mic nights and they're doing three shows and then they're working a day job. How do you tell them to prepare? Because I think what you're saying is there's a way, of, and you talk about it in the book, about self-care, showing up to a show. What would you tell them?
Yeah, this was exactly where it started for me, as I realized when I had auditions, I was always really careful with myself on the days I had auditions. You know, I would go and work out in the morning. I would take time for my prayer and meditation practice. I wouldn't answer the phone, so I didn't get sucked off into anybody else's bullshit. You know, I was really careful to look nice and then be really present in the waiting room and in the audition room to really, you know, try to connect with the people there. And I always tried to schedule something nice for myself afterwards, you know, lunch with a friend or something, so that I always had something to look forward to. And then I was like, why is this not my everyday life? Like, why is this a special occasion? And the minute I started treating myself just that much better, I mean, I'm not saying go get a mud wrap in Napa, although why not? But when I started just making sure that my own self-being was fed and rested, it, you know, things right there, things started to change for me.
How did you see your performance change in those auditions as you were applying self-care to your life?
Well, you know how it is when you show up exhausted and stressed out and with no sense of humor and still thinking about that bullshit thing that happened this morning. Like, you're not really there. And you're not a very good listener. You're really reactive. You take everything really personally. The slightest thing throws you off. You know, you can't find parking and all of a sudden it's a disaster of national proportions. But on the other hand, when you do take care of yourself and you are working on something you love and you take time even just to breathe, even just to take, you know, I talk about this 4-7-8 breathing in the book, just to take a breath before you get out of the car, then you're really, like I said, you're really there for what's happening. And to notice that it's not about the result of the audition. It's about the process of the audition. It's not about the result of meeting this person. It's the process of meeting this person. You don't know where your life is going. So you got to pay attention along the way.
How do you get into to really, what you're saying is love the process. Screw the results, love the process. But if I've been, you know, slugging it away, you know, 8 or 9 years and, you know, I haven't made a house team and all this stuff, how do you tell somebody who's maybe auditioned for Second City 5 or 6 times and hasn't gotten in, how do you tell them to love the process? And why is that important?
Oh, God, this is such a heartbreak because I auditioned for Second City 5 or 6 times. I mean, I was working, I got a job there in 1985 and I left, like you said, in 94. So I was in that building for a long, long time. And I auditioned every year for a long, long time and always made it right to the end and then didn't get cast. And there's been a lot of things in my life that I've wanted and not gotten, you know, and I think you need to remind yourself what you're really in this for. Because if what you're in it for is approval, if what you're in it for is other people's, you know, appreciation from other people, if what you're in it for is status, you're going to be disappointed no matter how well you do. So I'm not saying don't want what you want. And in fact, I think there's an important thing that I don't actually talk about in the book that I think of as a creative dichotomies, which is when two things are equally true and opposite at the same time. So like we want things to be safe and normal and predictable and the same, and we want things to be new and exciting and different. And we want both of those things equally at the same time. And when it comes to your goals, on the one hand, you have to set your goals and be fucking relentless about getting there. And on the other hand, you have to surrender. Things have their own time. Things are unfolding in their own way. You know, you've got to be peaceful in the present moment as you are moving towards the life that you and the divine are co-creating together.
We are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about goal setting. And this is something you've mentioned it a little, but I want to go a little deeper into goal setting because goal setting drives me nuts. But I see it work in a lot of people's lives. And you have some very practical tools on goal setting. So we'll be back with Samantha Bennett. She's the author of Start Right Where You Are. So Samantha, I want to talk about goal setting because I am so frustrated with goal setting. I can't tell you. And the one thing I've struggled with goal setting is I will set goals, right? And then I don't get it. And then I think, screw this. I don't believe in goals. Goals are bullshit. So for people that are out there, and let's say, I think one of the hardest things to achieve now in improvisation is to be on a UCB Herald team. They have tons of people audition. They only have so many slots. What do you tell someone who's auditioned a few times and they haven't gotten it? And that's been their goal. They set that goal and they haven't gotten it.
Yeah. So that's a misstep in goal setting. It's very challenging when you set goals that are in somebody else's control. Right. Ultimately, you don't have control over whether or not you get onto a UCB house team. So you need to set goals over which you have 100% control.
Give me an example.
So I want to show up at this audition and do the best job I feel like I can do.
Mm-hmm.
I want to have 8 conversations this week with people who have gotten on UCB teams to maybe see if there's something I don't know that they know. I want to call 10 agents this week. I want to be on stage this week. I mean, like that, you know, something that broad you can control. Like, okay, I did it. I got on stage. It was at the, you know, dais in the Barnes & Noble for 5 minutes, but it happened, you know.
What about the devil advocate and myself who said, well, that's great. Those are achievable goals. But you know what? Isn't that really thinking small?
No, I mean, because you can say, I want to write a book. I want to start a TV show on, you know, I'm going to hold up my iPhone and start a TV show right now. hi, welcome to the Sam Bennett and Jimmy Crane Show. You know, like you can make it as big as you want, but you need to have the power to execute the goals within your own, like I said, in your side of your own mind and where your hands and feet can touch. It has to be something you yourself can do. So anything else that somebody else gives you, that's gravy.
What's the danger of saying, I want to be on Saturday Night Live, or I want to have a HBO comedy special, or I want to do Key and Peele, I want to do a sketch show on Comedy Central. What's the danger of that?
Well, again, it's very product. You know, it's like saying, I want to get on stage and have people applaud. It's like, well, okay, but there's a process that gets you there. And if you're not paying attention to the process as you're getting there, you may well get that show on Comedy Central and find out that you're freaking miserable. And you and I both know people that's happened to.
Yes, we do.
Right?
Yes.
So, but when you are present for each moment of your life, and you're asking yourself, like, one little thing you can do is just say, okay, how can I make this moment more me? How can I make this moment more me? This conversation, this email, this outfit, this scene, like, how can I just show up a little 1% more authentically in this moment right now?
And give me an example of what people could do to be a little, show up a little more like them.
I think one thing we've all experienced is, like, you're in line at the grocery store and you're just in line at the grocery store, and then somebody makes a joke or somebody says something, you know, somebody says, hey, how do you cook a turnip? You know, and all of a sudden you're like there and you're having a real human experience with the checker or with another person in line. And all of a sudden your life is a little bit richer. Like you've had a little bit more humanity in the world. You've contributed a little bit more. So it's going to look different for everybody. You know, it may be that you show up a little more with a little more fragility and a little more delicacy than you might otherwise. Or maybe it means that you make the joke that your mother would think is inappropriate, or maybe, you know, who knows? It's going to be different times and different circumstances. But I find that answering the question, how can I make this moment more me, is easier than the question, what do I want?
And what is preventing us from doing that? Because really, again, you know, the people that we know from Chicago that have gone on, there's a sense of authenticity. There's a certainly they're who they are, and they're not apologizing for that. So I forgot what my question was. This has never happened.
See, you're still getting so engaged in the present moment, you're losing track of
you. Is that good? I totally space something out?
Yeah, it's completely, I mean, could it be more authentic?
You're not going to get more authentic than me forgetting a question. And now it's coming back to me. See, this is amazing. This is amazing. Samantha, the work you're doing with me on this podcast is, I think after this, I'm going to get a 3-picture deal somewhere.
I think you might.
Yes. I think people today and people that we've known from Chicago, there's that authenticness, you know, like they've got it because they're not apologetic. It's who they are, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. Like there's, like I say, there isn't the way, you know, if there was just a checklist of like, you know, how to get on the main stage, we would have done it, you know, yeah. But there isn't. And it was one of the things I remember being really frustrated about at Second City. And, you know, you got to remember, I was the assistant to the producers for a long time. I was married to one of the directors for a long time. Like I really saw how the sausage was getting made back there. And the rules were different all the time. Like, oh, well, we're going to let this person, you know, jump from Turco to main stage because of this reason. And well, we're going to hold this person back though, because of this exact same reason. And we're going to do this because of this. And we're going to do this because of this. And for those of us who were trying to make it, it was like so frustrating. Because like, what are the rules? Just tell me what the rules are and I'll do that. Except we probably wouldn't, because we're not really good at following rules anyway. but again, when you
experience, see, I mean, that was a real education. What did you learn from seeing that?
Well, that the value that a person brings to a cast is individual. And different casts need different things. sometimes the most talented person doesn't get the job because they outweigh, because they would off balance the cast. Sometimes you need somebody for the audience to hate. Sometimes you have a cast of great creative minds, but not so much with the writing. You know, they're not really good about sitting down and writing. So you need to counterbalance with somebody who may not be as quote unquote funny, but is a better writer. So it's a whole picture that I think the individual actor can't always see.
And how have you seen that, you know, as you've done TV parts and in your business and writing books, how is that like a through line for just life?
Yeah, so you need to keep showing up. When you keep showing up as authentically as you possibly can, not only are you enjoying the process a lot more, but truly your success becomes inevitable because you become indelible. Your work is so you that people remember you. And you may not be right now. You may not be right for the next part. You may not be right for the next part. But I mean, I got called in by a casting director who hadn't seen me for 12 years. And she remembered the audition I had given for her 12 years ago. I didn't even remember the audition I had given for her 12 years ago. But that's what happens when you keep showing up, doing your thing that's important to you, your way.
And what prevents us? What's the fear? What is the underlying fear of not doing that? Not being 100% authentic? Because getting back to the people we know and just my obsession with fame and success and stuff like that, the people that seem to really hit it are the ones that are, it's them, you know, they're maybe in its exaggeration of them, but it's them authentically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now I've forgotten the question.
What is the reason? What is the fear?
Oh, why we're afraid. Yeah. We're
afraid to show that because to me, that is our goal. You know?
Yeah. So it's a survival mechanism, right? We are tribal animals. We know, our animal brain knows, our limbic system knows that we cannot survive alone. As much as we may wish that everybody else would just go away sometimes, we know we can't survive alone. So we are very attuned to the needs of the group. And we're very sensitive to anything that we think might upset the group. And we want to be seen as generous and as contributing and as worth it so that they don't put us out on an ice floe. And we get a lot of mixed messages from that culturally, right? You know, stand out, fit in, be different, but don't be weird. You know, be different, but don't be weird. Be you, but don't be weird. And, you know, we're the weird kids. We got punished for being weird socially and possibly physically
until we theater and improv and we got rewarded.
Exactly. And then there's a little collapsement sometimes between being weird and being special. And we feel like if we give up our specialness, you know, and start thinking of ourselves as being a little more normal and ordinary, we might give up that which is, you know, has been so sparkly about us for so long. So it's a totally normal struggle. It's not low self-esteem. It's pure survival. And but to understand that you come to the tribe with special gifts and the ability to self-reveal is very powerful. And the more authentic you can be, the more permission you give for other people to be themselves. And that's really welcoming. That's God's own work, right?
And how does that look when you say that? Because how does that work?
In some ways, it's the essence of yes and, right? Somebody says, well, gosh, you know, you seem a little abrasive, or you seem a little depressive, or you seem a little too cheerful, or you seem a little, right? That's things we've heard our whole lives. Like, I'm too this, I'm too that, I'm too this, right. I'm too that. And for you to go inside and really feel it, like, and I use the word sometimes. I'll put the word sometimes on the end. So like, I'm too sensitive sometimes. Is that true? And I'm like, oh, fuck yeah. Like, I'm too sensitive pretty much all the time. And then I can say, yes. Yes, what you're seeing about me is true. And when you say yes like that, the charismatic light bulb goes off. People can't resist you.
I want to be more charismatic.
Well, you do. I mean, when you talk about, you know, I'm begrudging and I'm depressive and I'm going to take this personally and I'm still mad about, you know, whatever, that's charismatic. It's one of the things I think people love about the show is your truth in yourself, but, and the things that bring you joy.
But it's funny because, Samantha, I don't think of that as being charismatic. I just think of that as being negative.
Right. And, but for you, a certain negativity is charismatic. And this is really important to learn. There's nothing they're not buying out there. Right? I mean, they gave Howard Stern $500 million. $500 million twice. For what? Being disgusting and puerile and hilarious and truth-telling and gross. You know, and at the same time, we give, you know, whatever, American Girl dolls. You know, there's nothing too sweet. There's nothing too manic. There's nothing too intelligent. If it's authentically you, then lean into it because we need it.
The other thing about goal setting that I've seen, and you talk about this in this book, is, you know, you set a goal, like, you know, I want to write a book, I think is the example in your book. And then all of a sudden, two nights later, you're at a dinner party and there's a literary agent there who, you know, you talk up and you schmooze a little with and you make a connection. What? I've never been able to figure that one out.
Here's what I think happens. Yeah, it's amazing, right? We've all had that experience where you take a couple of little tiny steps towards a goal and it's like the universe comes rushing at you. And the key is the movement. The key is making those couple of steps. It's taking 15 minutes a day to write. It's declaring your intentions publicly. It's really getting in there and getting out of deciding and getting out of researching and getting out of I don't know and getting out of I don't, no one will let me. And once you're actually in it, that's when things start to happen.
And you also address this in the book. And this is what I struggle with. I am a procrastinator and a perfectionist. So let's say one of my goals is to do an HBO special. So you've given me the steps, you know, the things that I can control. I can write every day for 15 minutes. I can go to do one open mic a week. Those are very, very doable. But what happens for me is I then get into the perfectionism and the procrastination. And I'm like, well, you know what? If it's not going to be perfect, I'm not going to take those actions. Those actions are the hardest thing for me to take.
Yeah. So I think two things are useful here. One is to redefine perfect. Because you've got an idea of what perfect is in your head. And you're trying to get your life to match that template. But you got to remember, none of the rest of us can see that. We can't see that perfect version in your head. All we see is what you actually do. And for most of us, what you're actually doing looks great. It looks great. So drop this idea that there's some other version of you leading a slightly more successful version of your life somewhere that you're still running to catch up with, right? And understand that what you're doing, you know, everybody's doing the best they can with the information they have at the time. Sometimes our best is really crappy, but it's still the best we can do. And instead, redefine perfect as like, I think a perfect like a leaf, you know, or perfect like a baby, perfect like Betsy is perfect, you know, like just go like this, it's not without flaws, not without weaknesses, but perfect in that it is whole and entire unto itself. So that's one thing.
Okay, and the other thing?
And then a more practical thing is, this really saved my bacon with goal setting, is to set good, better, best goals. Because I was often afraid to commit to a goal because I can get like I'm getting chased by a pack of wild dogs. Like I can get a little relentless about my goals, and that's not always pretty. So, but if I say, like, let's say I'm doing a workshop and I have to have 20 people in it, I would love to have 30 people in it. And if I have 40 people in it, drinks are on me. So if I set those goals, like one I'm almost positive I can do, and if I can't, that's a big signal that something's wrong. One that feels really good, solid, you know, yay, that would be a win. And then kind of a stretch, but it would be really cool. And this helps keep me from moving the finish line on myself, because we do this all the time, right? Like, oh, sure, I made it into Turco, but when am I going to get into ETC? You know, sure, I made it into DTC. When am I going to get to the main stage? Like, the minute we achieve something, we completely forget about how much we wanted it, and we just focus on the next thing. So to be able to say, all right, I got 32 people into this class. And rather than going, oh, I really wanted 40. It's like, no, yes, you wanted 40, but 40 was a stretch. And you said 30 was good, and you got 32. That's a big win. Buy yourself a cup of coffee, celebrate, be happy.
The other thing that I struggle with, and I've gotten much better at it, but I'll go and I'll do a show. And I've talked about this on the podcast. And it's the show, according to my standards, sucks. And then I will get into this shame spiral, just really bad depression, almost suicidal thoughts. And then, the next day, hopefully it's gone. But, you know, that's two hours of my life where I am just beating the crap out of myself. What is there anything I can do to prevent this?
Well, I have something you could try.
Okay.
It's probably my favorite exercise in the book. And as you point out, the book is like a million different teeny tiny little chapters. Like there's two pages, some of them, and they all have a little exercise that's very doable, you know, very actionable. But this one's probably my favorite. So you're in a mood you can't get out of, mm-hmm. right?
I've just done a terrible, terrible show.
You've done a terrible show. You're mad at yourself. You're mad at your team player. You're mad at that stupid audience member who said spatula for the 977th time.
Right. And I want to quit, and I feel like I'm not worthy as a person.
Right. Make some 5-minute art about it.
And tell us what that is.
Yeah. So make some 5-minute art about it means grab a piece of typing paper and make a stick figure drawing of how it feels, of what that feeling is like, that feeling of hopelessness and I suckness and everybody else sucks too. Or do a little dance or make up a song or something. Get out your Sculpey clay. I don't know. However it is you like to express. And the purpose of this is twofold. One, feelings just want to be felt. Feelings just want to be felt. That's all they want. And once a feeling knows it's been felt, it can get promoted and get a better job. Right? That energy can get freed up. As opposed to keeping that feeling locked away or telling yourself you shouldn't be feeling that way, because that doesn't work at all, right? So that's one. Feelings just want to be felt. And giving a feeling form allows it to know that it's been felt. It also allows you to interact with that feeling in a slightly different way, because when it's happening inside of your head, it's all really confusing and dark and it feels really real. But once it's on paper or once it's in form outside of you, you can start to get a slightly different perspective on it. And I'll give you an example. I was doing a podcast interview with a woman who has a podcast, but she also still has her full-time job. And she's reading the book and she gets to the make some 5-minute art about it exercise. And she's like, oh yeah, that's cool. I should do that sometime. Right? Like we all do. Yeah. I should do that sometime. But then she has this unbelievably shitty day at work and she gets home and she's really upset. And then she sees my book on the table and she's like, oh, I'll make some 5-minute art about this because I'm so upset. So she makes a drawing that's her kneeling in the center of the page and everyone from work around her throwing rocks at her.
Pretty dark. Pretty dark.
Yeah, pretty dark, right?
I relate.
Me too. I've totally had that feeling. So first of all, now she's got something that we can all really, you know, she could take that drawing to her partner or her spouse and say, this is the kind of day I had, right? And start to have a different kind of conversation about how she's feeling. But here's what happened. She looked at it and she was inspired then to make a second drawing, still with her kneeling, still with everybody throwing rocks, and her with an invisible shield around her. And she said the shield was the love of God. So she goes into work the next day with a totally different mindset because she knows that she is protected by God's love.
Now, the cynic in me, and I would imagine there's some who listen to this podcast, are saying, is it that easy?
You know, yeah. It kind of is. And this is what I mean by little 1 degree shifts, right? Because we all know what happens when she goes into work the next day feeling like everybody's still throwing rocks at her. We can pretty easily make up the story of how that day goes and how that, and even how that career goes. But we can also make up a story of how it goes when she goes in there impervious to the feeling that they're throwing rocks at her, when she's able to reassure herself over and over and over again that she's safe and that she belongs in the world. I mean, it's a tiny shift, but it's a radical, radical difference. And I'll give you a little more. This is a little lighter, lighter version. I was
I love the dark.
Even though you love the dark, yeah, I know. But this is another one that was kind of fun. I was teaching a live event and a woman got up to the mic and she's like, Sam, she says, I hear you say this, make some art about it. And I don't really know what you mean. And I said, oh, good, great. So if you were to make some 5-minute, you know, if you were to make up a little song right now about how it feels to not know what I mean, how would that go? And she goes, I don't get it. 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 And she fell out and we all fell out. And then she goes, oh, now I get it. And I was so pleased because, you know, that feeling, that's a terrible feeling. Like everybody in this room is understanding something that I don't understand. Like I can see that feeling ruining my whole day and my whole weekend. You know, that could, it's very easy for me to feel lonely and like an outcast. Like that would do it for me. But the fact that she was willing to ask and then put it into form, and then we could all relate to it. We're all like, totally, I've totally had that feeling. And I still sing that song to myself all the time now. I'm like, I don't get it. I don't get it. I don't get it. I don't get it.
In the time that we've talked about this, I did draw the little stick figure, and it's me with a frowny face and then like arrows that I would try to have like knives going into me. So I don't know what that's about, but I did, you know, work on it as you were talking. I don't know if that's a good example of being present either.
I think it's fine. I often doodle. I often think better when my hands are busy. So, you know, I think it's fine. And where my mind goes with that is like, if you put a little caption under there that said like another Friday night for Jimmy Corain, mm-hmm. you know, just another day in show business. And, you know, took a picture of it and put it up as a little cartoon. I bet you would get about a zillion likes on that.
I may do that. That's a really good idea. Because, you know, getting liked on Facebook, that helps too. The other thing I loved about your book, and I've talked about this in the podcast, I know several times before, and I think it's something that I struggled with early on before I found recovery, before I found therapy, and that was I was depending so much on people in my groups to really give me that emotional and psychological support that I needed, you know, to keep going in this art form. And you lay out a chapter, basically, look, if you need outside help, get it.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Relying on the approval of others for your well-being is the express elevator to hell. Because you'll never get enough. Nobody can ever say enough nice things to you. And again, this tribal thing, you know, that 99 compliments and one criticism, right? Everybody says how great you are. And then one person says one thing that's a tiny bit critical. And that's all we hear. And again, it's a survival thing, right? It's more important for our brain to remember the one berry that made us sick than it is to remember the 99 delicious berries. So we're a little over programmed to remember the negative. But yeah, your well-being must come from within. Your sense of self-love must come from within. And speaking as someone who suffered from depression her entire life, like I had childhood depression before there was childhood depression. Like nobody knew that there was such a thing. I was just weird and sad. Like Judy Lurie counted how many times I cried in the fourth grade. Like there was a lot of crying. But when I realized like, oh wait, I'm not just weird. I'm sick. Like I've got a thing. This is an actual thing. And there's medication for this thing. And there's therapy for this thing. And there's ways to manage this condition that, you know, may never fully go away, but does not have to rule my life either.
And, I often, and I think this certainly is one of my agendas on doing this podcast is like, you know, if you need help, go and get help. You know, I mean, really go to a therapist, because I got to tell you something. I'm in group therapy twice a week for the last 10 years, and it's made a huge difference, not only in my life, but in my comedy. What is the resistance to actors and artists and for going in to get some therapy?
Well, like I said, I think a lot of it is that collapsement between the weird and the special. I think we're afraid if we give up the part of us that's weird, we're going to lose the part of us that's special. I've always been extremely self-reliant, right? So it's often challenging, I think, for people just to admit that they need help and accept help. There's also a lot of really shitty therapists out there. You know, I think I've certainly had the experience of like going to therapy and been like, oh, yeah, this is like, okay, great. I finally surrender my pride and sign and go to therapy. And this is what I get. But even crappy therapy can help. And yeah, it's a complicated beast. And I totally, you know, I was absolutely one of those people who's like, I would never take a pill every day. You know, I don't want to be that. I don't want to numb my emotions. Well, it turns out that Wellbutrin 300 XL does not numb your emotions. It just puts a basement on the house. And now I would punch anybody who got in between me and that medication every morning. So read The Noonday Demon by Andrew Solomon. If you think you have depression, if you suspect, read The Noonday, or someone you love does, read The Noonday Demon by Andrew Solomon. Not only is it an exquisite piece of writing, but it's the best deconstruction of depression I've ever seen.
Well, and I think, you know, the other thing that you bring up to me as you're talking about this, because I've suffered from depression my whole life as well, and certainly, you know, getting help has made a huge, huge difference. And I see, you know, as a teacher here, I see, you know, a lot of people doing many classes and you know, doing lots of shows and throwing themselves into it and saying, you know, I'm working really hard. I've been in Chicago for 6 or 7 years and it's just not happening to me. I think there's a part, and I'd really like to get your opinion, if you're struggling with mental illness, you're struggling with depression, that's going to impede your chances of succeeding. And I know it did for me.
Oh, 100%. 100%. And sometimes, you know, one of the things I really am aware of now is it often prevented me from noticing how well I was doing. You know, like there were times when I was like, I mean, I look back now and I'm like, that was really cool that happened. Like, that's amazing that I got to do a play with Elaine Stritch. That's amazing that I did a show with Richard Dreyfuss. That's incredible that I, you know, kind of booked my first big network audition. Like, that doesn't happen for everybody. Like, I could feel good about that, but I certainly didn't at the time, you know? So yeah, I think it's preventing you from noticing a lot of what's good in your life. There's a great physical toll to depression. It's, you know, it affects your sleep, it affects your appetite, it affects your connections with other people. And it's important to remember too that it's a global disease, right? It's a chemical problem, it's a spiritual problem, it's a psychic problem, it's an emotional problem, it's a nutritional problem. Like it's across the board. So you kind of have to come at it from a couple of different angles. And I think do yourself a favor and start to be frank about it, because I was stunned when I started talking about it, how many people in my life were on some kind of medication, had struggled with exactly the same thing. This thing that I thought was so isolating and so lonely has actually turned out to be a real bridge. And I gotta say, all this anxiety, this thing about things being a bridge, like all that fear that I'm not good enough and no one cares and I work so hard and no one notices, and everybody feels that way. Everybody feels that way. I work with Emmy Award winners, Academy Award winners, people who've written multiple books. Everybody feels that way. Everybody feels like a fraud. Everybody feels, you know, everybody feels this way. So to understand that those anxieties and that feeling that you want it to be perfect and you're not moving as fast as you want and all that stuff, don't let that be a wall. Let that be a bridge. Notice where you are being called forward. Like, okay, so you've been working hard for 6 or 7 years and you're not getting the results you want. Where are you being called forward? Where is the invitation for you to be what? To be a better communicator, to be more responsible, to be less active, to be more judicious about what you do, to be more compassionate towards yourself and others? Like, where's the invitation and the lesson in what it is you're facing?
And you talk about to be more judicious on what you decide to do. I think that's something I know I struggled with it when I first started. It was like, get into as many projects as I possibly can. Because my theory was, and I think improvisers still think that, some improvisers still think this way. It's you know, the more shows and projects I get in, the better chance one's going to hit. So I was someone who said yes to everything. Tell us why that is dangerous.
Yeah, I did the same thing. I use busy. Busy was far and away my favorite narcotic. And I still like to have like 3 or 4 kind of big impossible projects going at the same time. But notice I say 3 or 4, not 10 or 12, right? And the only question to ask yourself when you're going to invest anything in anything, so you're going to invest time in a project, you're going to invest money in a class, you're going to invest your heart in a project, is to ask yourself, what's the return on investment that I am expecting? What's the return on investment that I'm expecting? And that return can be spiritual, it can be educational, it can be personal, it can be financial. But to be really real with yourself about what is it that you're planning on getting out of this? Because if it's just another show, then you're just making yourself tired. You're just treading water, you know? But if you can say, okay, I'm doing this because I really feel like, you know, like this is going to make it worthwhile for me.
What if fame is on there? Is one of those things?
Well, I guess I would ask to get more specific about what kind of fame you're looking for. You know, how famous is famous enough?
You're doing the show and it's to get noticed. And I think a lot of times, I know for me, it's like, oh, it's going to take me to the next level. And I, to be honest with you, Samantha, I can't tell you what the next level is, but I'm looking to go there. So I get into a group, I do a project, and, you know, we're going to be, you know, we're going to get a show on Comedy Central, or we're going to, you know, whatever it is that was in my, or we're going to take this show and we're going to showcase it in LA. I mean, that's the crazy thoughts that went through my head.
Right. So, but again, we want to get really specific about the ROI. So if I do this show, the return on investment that I expect is that 3 agents will come and see it.
Right.
And I think that's going to move me forward. You know, the return on investment that I expect is that I'll get a really good workout because these people are really better improvisers than I am. You know, the return on investment I expect is that we're working towards a showcase in LA. And so I'm going to start a penny jar for my plane ticket and, you know, start talking to people who've done showcases in LA and see what they have to teach me.
I hate when you get so practical with me. I hate it.
I mean, you can have anything you want. I think fame is a little, you know, it's a little flimsy. And most of the people I know who are famous would trade it if they could.
You know what? I want to be in that position. And then when I'm out in LA, I'll say, you know what? You were right, Samantha. And
yes, I hope that for you.
You were right. It's miserable.
I hope that for you.
We've got to wrap this up, but I do want to end with the fear of success. So I've done these exercises in the book. I'm getting better. I've dealt with my depression because I go to therapy twice a week. I'm very judicious in terms of what projects I'm going to pick because now I know how to pick what projects are going to make me happy or what I'm going to get from it. And now I'm starting to feel the fruits of my labor here, and I'm starting to feel successful. But I'm coming up against this glass ceiling or this wall, which is fear of success. How are you going to help me get over it?
Yeah, I'd actually recommend you read another book. there's a terrific book by Gay Hendricks called The Big Leap that talks about upper limit issues.
I got it on my bookshelf.
Yeah, it's a good one, and it's not very long. It's a really quick read, and But this thing of upper limit issues is very real. I used to say that I didn't think there was such a thing as fear of success. I was like, no, I noticed that when people are successful, they're generally pretty pleased about it. But then I noticed that wasn't actually true. And I saw a lot of people have something be successful, and then they would beat it with a stick until it died. Or, you know, keep their foot on the neck of their own career.
Well, so that it wouldn't, and right? And for me, it was self-sabotage. And I didn't even realize it until, you know, months and in some cases years later that that's what I did.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's very, very real because we all have, you know, we have an inner comfort level. So one thing I would do is there's that theory about how you're the average of the five people you hang out with most. So if you take the five people you hang out with most, you are probably right in the middle in terms of success, energy, income, positivity, productivity, weight. Like there's a lot of things. So if you want to have more energy, be more positive, have more success, you may need to change some of the people you're hanging out with.
That's really hard for me because my strategy is hanging out with people that are more fucked up than me. And I'm embarrassed to admit it.
How's that working for you?
It's not.
So there you go.
But it's very hard to let go of that because growing up in my family, I was always the fuck up. So I'm very comfortable finding somebody else to be the fuck up, you know, and just basically hiding behind, you know, I'm hiding behind them in a weird way because I'm like, you know, at least I'm not as bad as they are.
Yeah, I would drop the story that it's hard.
Okay.
I think it can be really easy and fun.
Finding new friends.
Yeah, finding people who inspire you and challenge you and who love you and think what you're up to is incredible and can't wait to support you and help you notice opportunities that maybe you might be blind to. Yeah.
So now I've got a new bunch of friends, successful people. I'm in the middle. I'm feeling great. And now I'm starting to get the things that I really, really want. And the weird thing is feelings are coming up, like anger and sadness. There's a little joy, but it's more of anger and sadness. What's going on in me now?
Well, you may be having a delayed reaction. You know, it may be anger and sadness that you didn't let yourself feel before that you're feeling now. But I have to tell you, one of the things that human beings are really, really bad at is affective prediction.
Which what?
Which is, means we're terrible at predicting how we're going to feel in a future situation.
But there is a myth or there's a lie that if I get, let's say I'm a regular on NCI or whatever, and that's one of my goals, that my life is going to be, I'm going to feel so much joy.
Right. So joy does not come from external circumstances. Joy only comes from inside. And that's really what the book is all about, is learning how to stay calm and centered and joyful and contented and fulfilled, no matter what's happening, no matter if the greatest news in your life, you know, you're standing up there accepting the Academy Award for greatest person of all time, or you've just lost the person you treasure most, you know, or you've lost all your money, or, you know, circumstances happen to everyone. Everyone gets the same amount of pain. Everyone gets the same amount of pain. Nobody's life is easier for them than your life is for you. And we do ourselves and them a deep disservice when we look at somebody else and go, oh, well, it must have been easy for them. You know, sure, Jimmy can have a podcast. He's got all those, you know, friends. Oh, Sam can write a book. She this, she that. Oh, you know, so-and-so can have a TV show. No, it's not easier for Jimmy. It's not easier for me. It's not easier for anybody. It's just as hard for everyone as your life is for you. So you need to figure out what it is that brings you joy in this present moment so that no matter what happens in your life, you are leading an enriched life. You're getting the most out of your precious and brief, brief life.
You have gone from improviser, actor, to author. What are some of the tools that you use in your writing that you've taken from improv?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I think improv prepares you so well for a life of everything. Probably the main one, and this was really true with this last book actually, is trusting the process. Like really developing the ability to ignore those inner critic voices that say, this sucks, you're useless, nobody cares. Who do you think you are anyway? And just keep writing, keep writing, keep writing. I was like, Samantha, this is why God made editors. Like, just get it on the page. It's okay if it's terrible, they'll write you back and say, Sam, this is terrible. Make it better. So that's one big part of it. The ability to look on mistakes and problems as gifts and opportunities, I think, has been huge, both as an author and as an entrepreneur. The understanding that really nothing bad is happening. And, you know, when you're improvising and the game breaks or somebody makes, you know, a mistake in the scene or missteps, and that's where the scene breaks open. That's always where the scene breaks open, right? That's where you have the opportunity to heighten and transform.
Do you have something in your business or as you're writing that, you know, it's like, oh, it seemed like a mistake. I feel a lot of shame about this. And then it turns out to be a gift, just like an improv.
You know, right when I was turning in the final manuscript of this book, I was also launching my Get It Done workshop, which is something I teach online once a year. And we were scheduled to start the class on a Wednesday. And, you know, I launched the thing. I get a bunch of people signed up. It's great. I teach the first class. Yay, that went well. I check my email and there's a ton of emails from students saying, weren't we starting today? Like, I never got the login information. I'm like, oh no. And it turned out there was an error in the email campaign, in the timer. So some of the people in the class got the information and some of the people didn't. Now, my business is called the Organized Artist Company. This is not great for me. No. When stuff like this happens, right? This is not great branding. So I say, okay, do over. I'm going to teach this first class again on Saturday. And oh, guess what? That gives me another couple of days to promote the class. Maybe there's some people who were thinking about signing up, but then they missed the deadline, and now this gives them a second chance. Great. So I'm writing the email that says, hey, you've got a second chance to enroll in this class. And I write an email that I've been meaning to write for a long time based on a letter that somebody wrote to me about how this self-help stuff doesn't really work and what I thought about that. And as I'm writing the email, I'm realizing, oh, shit, this is how the book needs to start. So I quick email my editor. I'm like, I need the book back for just 2 seconds. And I slap that on as a little introduction and send it back. And so now something that looked like not just a mistake, but really kind of a bad mistake, allowed me to overserve to my clients, to give them more, to get more people into the class, and then also to get a message that I felt really strongly about out to thousands and thousands of people through the book.
We've got to wrap this up. This has been great. And we end the podcast with the same question. What would you tell somebody starting out in improv today?
Do it. Don't not do it. And take everything that's making you feel afraid or making you feel smaller than or less than, and again, think of it as a bridge, as an invitation. You know, your improv work is calling you forward, and it's your job to fulfill that quest and that opportunity. I would also say, don't make jokes.
And can you explain?
Well, I should say avoid joke making. Like, I think it's a common error to focus on. You know, when you're making jokes, you're writing inside of your head, and then you should be a writer. You know, I think the best improvisations and the best improvisers that I've ever seen never go for a joke. They always go for character. They always go for truth. And then you get the stuff that's deeply, deeply funny because it's set up its camp right at the intersection of where comedy and tragedy meet. And that's so much better than a joke.
Samantha Bennett, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd. Her book is called Start Right Where You Are.
There you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. I want to thank our guest, Samantha Bennett. Sam Bennett is her pen name. And her book is Start Right Where You Are, How Little Changes Can Make a Big Difference. Also like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you would not be hearing my voice right now. Also, Sam Bowers, the director of Improv Nerd. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes, workshops, and intensives called The Art of Slow Comedy, and to sign up for the Improv Nerd blog newsletter, go to my slick website at jimmycorain.com. Also, follow us on social media. Like us on our Improv Nerd page on Facebook. It really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd, and subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is Improv Nerd Podcast, where you will see clips from our live show. We are blessed. We are so blessed to be part of this podcast collective called feralaudio.com. They have some of the most popular comedy podcasts out there right now, so check it out, feralaudio.com. And of course, I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior. Happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL. The 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pe in Spanish,
oh my God.
He spots his dear friend, who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh, my God.